Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Writer and State College native Sunil Yappa bases his highly acclaimed debut novel, The Heart is a Muscle the Size of Your Fist, on the largest demonstration of its kind in U.S. history. In November 1999, more than 50,000 protesters took to the streets of Seattle, Washington, to demonstrate against the World Trade Organization's ministerial conference. It was to launch a new round of global trade negotiations with representatives from 135 countries. It came to be known as the Battle of Seattle. Yappa was a Penn State student at the time, studying economic geography. What made the WTO protests so life-changing for him? And just how relevant are the events of that protest today? We'll talk about that and more. Sunil Yappa, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a huge pleasure. I've been listening to your show since I was a little kid, Patty, so this is a enormous pleasure for me.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah.
You were a college student, safe and sound on the campus of Penn State in 1999, when the largest, many would say, anti-globalization protest in U.S. history unfolded in Seattle, Washington. What was it about the so-called battle in Seattle that so captivated you that you decided to write a novel about it?
Yeah, it's interesting. It really did captivate me at the time. You know, so my dad teaches at Penn State. He's been teaching geography at Penn State since I was a kid, since the 70s. And so I knew a lot about economic development, and I knew a lot about the trade issues and kind of the sweatshops and some of the environmental laws that were being broken. And so I knew a lot about the protests. But I guess at that time in 99, globalization wasn't really on people's radar. And 60,000 people going to the streets was such a public display of that it really, it moved me. And there in Pennsylvania, it made me feel a lot less alienated and less alone seeing that so many people were in the street. But I never thought about writing about it. At the time, I was writing fiction. I was writing short stories. I was writing a lot of sort of Jhumpa Lahiri-inspired Sri Lankan immigrant in central Pennsylvania stories, which, to be honest, wasn't really my true subject. When I got to grad school in New York City, I was studying with Colm McCann and Peter Carey, and Colm really pushed me to write outside of myself and to try to write outside of my experience. So I was looking around for a novel, and I was reading Don DeLillo's Libra, which is a retelling of the biography of Lee Harvey Oswald. It's a fascinating book, fiction. And I thought, wow, you can write a novel about recent American history in an American vernacular. And I thought, wow, what would be interesting for me to do? And I immediately remembered the WTO protests and how important they were to me.
Well, the interesting thing about this idea of writing outside of yourself, the best-known tenet of good writing is write what you know, and there is so much of you in this book, whether it's interweaving your knowledge of economic geography and the way geography plays a role in the WTO protest to begin with, the fact that there were 13 roads that converge and make their way to the convention center where this conference was to be held. But I wanted to step back a minute because at the heart of this, this is a story about a father and a son. So give listeners a quick synopsis of the story.
It's a father-son story that happens to be set at the largest protest against globalization since the Vietnam War. But the son is Victor. He's 19, loosely, I suppose, based on myself. His mother dies when he's 16. He's biracial. He's left with his father, who is the police chief and is practicing a form of tough love, trying to get his rich son ready for the world. But it's a little bit too tough. And he's not really listening to his son. And so Victor ends up running away and working odd jobs, and he ends up traveling the world for 3 years. And on the day that the book takes place, Victor has returned to Seattle and has a terrible, terrible plan to sell weed to the protesters in order to buy another plane ticket. And if you know anything about these kind of direct action, sort of militantly nonviolent protests, there are no drugs at all. I mean, these are very serious movements or actions. So it's a terrible idea to be selling drugs at the protests. He gets sucked in as sort of a naive observer and becomes really a central part of the protest. He's so desperate to belong to a family. He feels estranged from his father, and he doesn't have a mother, and he ends up in really the most vulnerable and dangerous of all the positions in the protest, which is lockdown, which is 8 to 12 people would make a circle, chain themselves with pipes, and clog the intersections.
And this is something he did almost on a whim. Someone rescues him from what could have been a pretty bad encounter with police. And next thing you know, he decides to join the protest. He was basically apolitical up until that point.
Yeah, he's seen the world. So he has a sense of global inequality, but I don't think he has a framework or any sort of dogmatic ideology to understand it through. So I think it's one of those moments when he's adopted by the protesters, something clicks for him, and he thinks, yeah, this is what I've been looking for all this whole time. And also, on the other side of the fence is his father, who's the chief of police. And so I think there's an element where he says, not only do I feel really at home in these protests, but screw you, Dad.
It's interesting because you say, to some extent, if any of the characters are based on you, it is 19-year-old Victor, who is biracial. And one thing you bring up in many interviews is the fact that you yourself are biracial. Your father was born in Sri Lanka, your mother in Montana. So to what extent is this story plucked from your real life, especially when you talk about feeling alone in the world?
You know, I think being from two cultures, and it's not necessarily, I do say biracial, but you could say bicultural or anyone who's grown up in a number of different cultures or different countries. I remember growing up in State College and my mom and dad arguing about whether it was proper to eat with your hands, that would be my dad's view, or to eat with a fork, which was my mom's view. And not just whether it was better, but whether it was like proper, the correct way to eat, you know? You're a barbarian if you eat with your hands, and you're an idiot if you eat with a fork. So early on, I think I had a sort of double consciousness and an ability and just the natural inclination to see things from at least two sides. So that's really filtered into my writing. And I think a book that looks at protests from seven different perspectives, it's not really a protest novel. It's an examination of protest because we have two protesters, we have two police officers, we have the chief of police, we have his son, and then we have a delegate from Sri Lanka who actually wants to get to his meeting. So I think that...
And also has the same goal in mind as many of the protesters. I want to do the same things you want to do, and that's make things better for my people.
That's right. That's really interesting. Yeah. I think that it's funny that all seven of those characters, even though they're completely at odds with each other, all think they're doing the right thing, in fact.
And that, I think, is sort of the beauty of your novel, because you don't, in a way, take a position. You're not talking about the naive protester or the greedy corporations, although that's all in there. It seems even-handed in very many ways. There's empathy for each one of their positions.
Yeah, I think as a writer, I had no interest in standing on a soapbox and talking about my own political views. I would write an essay if I wanted to do that. But as a novelist, and one of the great powers of literature, and one of the reasons I love reading, you know, as much as I love writing, is that we get to experience other people's lives. And so for me as a writer, the challenge was to try to empathize with characters very different from myself. And that was both very challenging, and it required a lot of very detailed research, but also incredibly fun and incredibly exciting to try to understand someone else's viewpoint.
What were the challenges and actually the benefits of writing about a recent historical event? Because a lot of what's in this book actually did happen in real life, and there's only one instance, which we'll talk about in a minute, where you bent the truth, and that's with your Sri Lankan diplomat.
It's that's a great question. It's both in some ways an enormous curse and a great blessing to write a book about recent American history. It's a curse in the sense that the people that were there are still alive, and if I get it wrong, they will tell me about it for sure. And so I was actually terrified when I went to Seattle when the book was first published in January to do my first reading in Seattle, thinking maybe people were going to protest the book, but in fact, I got a really positive reaction. People were very interested to engage with what was true and what was imagined on my part. On the other hand, it's an incredible blessing because there's an amazing amount of resources. So I was able to go to the University of Washington. There's an archive in the basement. It's about 25 boxes of materials from firsthand accounts, diary entries, photographs, VHS tapes, sound recordings, just everything. It's incredible. And in fact, one of the best resources I found, which is really neat, I think, was I found in the City Archive of Seattle recordings of all 5 days of the police scanner traffic. So that was one of the ways I was able to write police officers, is that I sat and listened to 5 days worth of the cops talking to each other and talking to the command center in a very intimate way. They don't, you know, they don't think anyone is listening. And the first time I heard a cop scared, actually nervous about the protests, I think that's when I've had an aha moment about, oh, I can write these characters.
The reality was he had good reason to be afraid. 50,000 to 60,000 people descended on Seattle, and only 900 police officers were called to duty that day.
That's right. And you know, the other thing, which I kind of mentioned in the book, is the cops had about 1 or 2 days of training, and the protesters, the core of protesters, had been training for 6 months. So it was really, they were really outmatched. And also, the protesters showed up early, and they had a very detailed plan. I honestly think calling it a protest is a misnomer. It was a direct action. They, as you mentioned, there was 13 intersections around the convention center, and they had been looking at maps for months, and they said, if we shut down these intersections, if we clog them, that no traffic will be able to get to the convention center. And that's what they did. And by the time the cops had figured out what had happened, it was over.
In your story, and I said a moment ago that you bent the truth a little bit to include the character, the financial minister of Sri Lanka, who is desperate to get to this conference because he is trying to get admission of Sri Lanka into the World Trade Organization. And to do that, he needs to meet with President Clinton. In reality, Sri Lanka was a member of the WTO back
Correct.
In 1944. Tell us a little bit about this character, because to some extent, I'm wondering if he's based on your father, who at one time was a consultant for the World Bank, which is considered by some who were in this protest as part of the unholy trinity, which includes the WTO and the International Monetary Fund.
That's right. I do need to clarify. So my dad has taught at Penn State for 35 years, teaching Geography 103, which is economics of the developing world. The projects that he would consult for on the World Bank were not at all unholy. He was actually one of the early adopters of computer mapping, and he worked for the UN Health Program, and he would work for the World Bank in the summers mapping malaria vectors. He wasn't doing development projects. He was really going out to show people how to use computer mapping. But yes, you know, it's not really based on his experience. One of the reasons that I used Sri Lanka trying to gain entry into the WTO instead of someone like Vietnam, who was actually trying to gain entry into the WTO in 99. I see a parallel between the processes of free trade and the processes of the World Trade Organization as a neocolonial process. And I saw a lot of parallels between that and what Sri Lanka had experienced under British colonialism. And so I made that switch because I knew so much more about Sri Lankan history and the stories of the character. For instance, he says he knows the geography of London as well as he knows the geography of his hometown in Sri Lanka. And that's something that my dad had told me.
Because he grew up under colonization. His first 8 years of life, Sri Lanka was colonized by the British.
That's right. And in fact, he tells a story that where when he was born, his family ran a hotel. My dad is the youngest of 10 kids, so big family. They're running a hotel. His oldest brother was getting married right at the same time that my brother was born. And they had a big wedding party, and there was a British encampment on the other side of the lake. And the British soldiers came over and said, "You need to turn the music down and stop the party. You're keeping us awake." They said, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." And they turned it down. The soldiers go back across the lake and turn the music back up again. The scene repeated itself 3 times until the British came back and said, "You're gone. We're taking in the hotel." And that they actually took it, and it caused kind of a mini diaspora of my dad's family. They didn't have another place where they could have 10 kids living in the same house. So My aunt has told me stories where they didn't see each other for years. The family was just spread out through towns in Sri Lanka for quite a few years.
Wow. If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia, and our guest is State College native and Penn State graduate Sunil Yapa. His highly acclaimed debut novel, The Heart is a Muscle the Size of a Fist, is based on the 1999 Seattle WTO protests. The book has been called a literary Molotov cocktail and a love letter to humanity. Tell us a little bit about the title of this book.
Yeah, your heart is a muscle the size of a fist. It's not a phrase that I invented. It's a phrase that comes out of the protests and, in fact, originates with an activist and librarian in Pittsburgh named Dahlia Shevin. And she created a woodcut that had that saying on it, and it became something that anti-globalization protests were well known for. But I discovered it in the archives in Seattle, and it was in a photograph. And I think I was calling the book at that time Seattle or Day One or something equally boring. But I saw that, Your Heart is a Muscle Size of a Fist, and I immediately thought, that's it. Because this is a book about the idea that empathy is a radical act. The idea that in a globalized world, we don't always have to pick up a rifle to have a revolution. And this sounds a little bit ridiculous, but the idea that really love and caring about people in other countries or in our own country in different situations than ourselves is actually a rather radical thing. I mean, it's amazing that we've come to a moment where kindness is a radical act, but I really do believe that.
Your Sri Lankan diplomat in this book says that this protest is sort of uniquely American, and you tell that on page, I think, 144 of your book. Can you read that section for us?
Sure, I'd love to. This is a page from Charles Vikramsingha, who is the Sri Lankan delegate who is there to try to go to the meetings, and he's not able to get to his meetings because the streets are blocked off. And one of the protesters has said, but we're out here to protect countries like yours. And so this is what Charles thinks. As if every soul that had ever breathed the air of Sri Lanka, the third world, had lived a miserable, ill-begotten life, died a nameless, unremarked death. Charles looked around. It was a strange idea. Did these people imagine America to be a place lacking in sorrow, suffering? And yet, there was something distinctly American about it all, a fundamental difference in perspective and place, and how they saw themselves in the world. And this was what made it so American, not that they felt compassion for mistreated workers three continents away, workers they had never seen or known, whose world they could not begin to understand. Not that they felt guilty about their privilege, no, not that either, but that they felt the need to do something about it. That they felt they had the power to do something about it. That was what made it so American. That they felt they had the power to do something, they assumed they had that power, they had been born with it, the ability to change the world. And they had never questioned its existence, an assumption so massive as to remain completely unseen, the power and responsibility to protect the people they imagined as powerless, the poor defenseless people of the third world. He felt a sudden queasy sadness. What if they knew what a real revolutionary was? How bloody is a real revolution? He looked around, suddenly feeling the need to sit, and saw nothing but their faces, their round, wet faces staring back at him. What a violence of the spirit to not know the world.
And of course, a real diplomat from Sri Lanka would have known the violence of the world because Sri Lanka, for at least a 26-year period, suffered in a civil war. But
That's correct.
Yeah, I wanted to say one of the things that was weaved throughout the story, and Chief Bishop says this so often to his son, is this idea of caring too much. He says, if you wear your heart on your sleeve, the world will just kill you cold. And that is repeated in different ways throughout the book.
I think that's absolutely the central question of the book is, so here's this sort of thesis I've made, which is the idea that compassion can be a radical act, and really a thesis that the protests themselves made, that compassion and caring about people in other countries is radical. And I guess I started to wonder, what are the consequences of that, and how far are we willing to go for our family, for people in other countries who we are starting to, who we might think are our family, and for love, really. And so it's, in some ways, this is the opposite perspective, you know, saying if you care too much about the world, or you care about every person in the world, you're going to suffer. You don't have a heart big enough. It would be like walking through New York City and trying to give money to every homeless person.
And there's
very difficult.
Yeah, there's a scene in the book where Jew, one of the police officers, is talking with Park, who's involved in a pretty ugly encounter. And the narrator says, knowing when to look and when to look away. That's really what police officers need to know.
Yeah, that's her perspective. That makes me a little sad to think that that's true. But I guess we all practice that in some ways. You know, we live in a world, we call it the information age, where we're exposed to so much information about so many parts of the world. I mean, if someone has a bicycle accident in Jakarta, we hear about it. So I think it can be overwhelming. And I do think there is some sense that it's possible to have compassion for people all over the world, but for me, I have to be selective about who I care about and who I engage with, or I get overwhelmed.
I think we all do. You know, the protesters who were in Seattle, they were there for a variety of reasons. Some were there because of concern for the environment, others because of economic policy, others who felt that democracy was being superseded by the World Trade Organization. Mm-hmm. This all seems so relevant today because we look at the cornerstone of Donald Trump's and Bernie Sanders' candidacies, and a lot of it is about fixing bad trade deals. So I'm just wondering, how relevant is this story 17 years after these protests?
It's very odd. I mean, you never set out to write a novel because it's timely. It took me 6 years to write this, so that's a terrible idea to do that. But it is. It seems incredibly relevant. Not only the trade issues, but the issues of police brutality and the issues of public protest. You know, And here we could get to an earlier question that you sort of implied, which is, were these really anti-globalization protests? And I don't think they were. I think what they were anti-corporate globalization, that globalization was happening in a way which was basically causing a race to the bottom, that corporations were being allowed to move their manufacturing facilities out of the U.S. and to the place where they could find the cheapest labor, where there were the least environmental regulations, things that we had fought for 100 years to have in the U.S., to protect our workers, to protect our environment, and to have a balance between business and social responsibility. And the way that some of the free trade agreements were being written seemed to benefit corporations and seemed to encourage this race to the bottom. And I think that was really what the protest was against. So when Donald Trump talks about you know, basically closing our borders, I think that's a bit absurd. We live in a global economy. And I think that the protest is not against a global economy. It's just asking for environmental regulations and labor laws to be included within that global economy. And if I could say one more thing about it, you know, simplest way to explain it for me is that as these free trade agreements have happened, it's become very easy for money to cross borders. We have 24-hour financial markets. It's become very easy for corporations to exist in any country they want, but it's become more and more and more difficult for people to cross borders. And I find that a little bit odd. I think that's one of the problems.
Interesting. Another interesting point about this book is that what readers have enjoyed and critics have raved about really isn't the book you wrote originally. You wrote this book, you finished it in 2010 while you were living humbly in Chile, in a place that had no internet and no cloud, none of that. And you also worked as a traveling salesman. You were in Chicago, and the first manuscript, which was 604 pages long, was stolen.
That's right.
To what extent is the book that we're all reading now the story you wrote originally? How much stayed the same?
Oh, I actually think I found about 100 pages I recovered. But I think there's probably less than 10 sentences of that original book. You know, it's interesting, though. I mean, of course, that was an incredibly depressing and traumatic experience. took me about 3 months to even start writing again or to even think about the project again. But I think it was a real gift in the end because it allowed that first draft, or that, although it was 2 years in the making, allowed me to make a lot of decisions about the story, about how I was going to approach it. And then I got to rethink those decisions. So, for instance, in the first book, there was about 60 characters. Madeline Albright was a character. It was a very very postmodern book. You know, there was sections from an encyclopedia that I had made up. It was like a pastiche of a lot of different things. And when I went to rewrite it again, I thought, you know, I love fiction because I care about characters. I'm going to focus on 7 characters that are complicated, that are layered, that break the stereotype, and that really move me. And I'm going to cut out all the postmodern fireworks and just try to tell good stories.
And you've reread your book several times. Is there anything in there that you would change?
About the book? Well,
today.
The next one, I don't think I'm going to do 7 characters, because even that is a lot. It's very fun to write 7 different perspectives. It's very difficult to make it readable. You know, it was very important to me. It's always the most important thing to me is how is the reader going to experience this book? And I wanted it to be a fast read and an easy read. I didn't want it to be difficult for people.
And it is,
but it took me 2 years to do that.
To do it.
I shouldn't admit that, but it took a long time to make it smooth.
Let me ask you this. You were toying, I think, for 10 years of following in your father's footsteps and becoming an academic, getting a PhD in geography. But somewhere in the back of your mind was this idea of becoming a writer. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So I've always been a reader. As a kid, I was a huge reader. When I was a teenager, I thought I wanted to be a writer, although I didn't really know what that meant. You know, there was some aspect of being the son of an immigrant. My dad never told me this. My dad likes writing. But there was some aspect that all the work and all the sacrifices he made to get to the U.S. and to allow my brother and I to have a middle-class life, there's some aspect where being an artist didn't seem a serious enough occupation to make good on that sacrifice. And so when I was about 19 and went to school, I gave up on that idea of being a writer or just didn't take it seriously. And I started studying geography. And you know, this is my dad's really, I think, the most brilliant person I've ever met. And I love what he teaches. And I think there's a lot of Penn State alumni out there who would attest to would say the same thing. And so I went and studied with my dad. And I really don't regret that for a second, because that background in geography and the education I got at Penn State in geography and in economic development became so important to me when I finally did decide to write. And in fact, I was getting ready to get a PhD in geography, and I took a year off and I went to China to teach English. And it took me about, I don't know, 2 weeks of being outside of the U.S., of being away from my own culture, to realize that I was going to write. And it was kind of perfectly timed, because here I had this education in geography that could then inform my own fiction writing. I'm very happy for all the English majors out there who end up writing books, but I think for me it was so valuable to have studied something else before I started writing.
All right. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, what a pleasure. Thank you, Patty.
That was Sunil Yapa talking about his debut novel, Your Heart is a Muscle the Size of a Fist, set during the tumultuous 1999 World Trade Organization demonstrations, later known as the Battle in Seattle. Yapa grew up in State College and earned his undergraduate degree in economic geography from Penn State. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.